and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, Chef Rob Kanin on Alaska's food culture. Hosted by the Smithsonian Arctic Studies Center, Chef Kanin was recorded speaking at the Anchorage Museum's Smithsonian Spotlight Lecture Series on October 4th. Alaska Food Culture with Chef Rob Kanin is coming up on Addressing Alaskans after the news. You're listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA with Chef Rob Kanin. His talk on Alaska's food culture was recorded at the Anchorage Museum Smithsonian Spotlight Lecture Series on October 4th.
Well, hello, my name is Dawn Bittison, and I'm the assistant curator for the Smithsonian Arctic Studies Center, which is located here at the Anchorage Museum. And tonight we're here for Smithsonian Spotlight, which is a series of lectures held every first Thursday of the month. And these are talks given by Alaska Native artists and scholars. So I invite you to come back the next first Thursday and thereafter. Tonight it's my honor to introduce tonight's speaker, Rob Kanin, an Alaskan chef of Tlingit heritage who's been working in restaurants since he was 15 years old. Rob has a degree from the Culinary Institute of America and fine-tuned his skills in all facets of the restaurant industry while working in the lower 48. He returned to Alaska, where his work has emphasized locally grown foods, Alaska-made products, and community involvement. Rob has been a chef at Seven Glaciers, the Crow's Nest, Orso, and Noble's Diner, where he was also owner. Rob contributes to cookbooks, gives cooking demonstrations, works on food development strategy with strategies with Alaskan companies, caters public and private events, and participates in cooking competitions. He also gives presentations throughout Alaska and nationally, advocating the use of local foods and sustainable practices, and he's recently premiered a line of Alaskan-inspired sauces, reinforcing the importance of sourcing locally. His wife, Carolyn, is a collaborative partner in much of his work, including the production of online webisodes about Alaskan regional cuisine and traditional indigenous foods. You can view these short films, find recipes, and learn more about Rob's work on his website, www.fresh49.com. Please join me in welcoming Rob Kanin.
Artist and scholar, I think that's my favorite part. So I'm gonna hold on to that. You don't hear that a lot being a chef. So Alaska's food culture. You know, currently I always kind of start with this, and I think these are pretty accurate, but my understanding is there's been actually a lot of emphasis over the year for rebate systems to kind of encourage restaurants to use local ingredients and things like that. I know farmers markets have actually jumped in number, almost double, I think, from like last year to this year. So I think things are switching, things are moving in the right direction. But, you know, at one point in the like last year, 95% of our food was actually imported from to Alaska. So the annual budget is $2 billion. And I always kind of point this out, like 1% of $2 billion is $20 million. And that's annually. That's an annual budget. So this is not a one-shot $2 billion deal. I mean, this is an annual budget. I've always kind of said, let's keep it in Alaska. And if we kind of think about that, I guess why? we kind of look over food security with these incremental increases. Food security, less dependability on importing to Alaska. Our state is lowly populated and tremendously large. So the food has to travel further without the population to kind of leverage the journey financially. That said, for greater benefits, we should be producing micro goods, not accepting macro goods. Health and wellness to Alaskans. I mean, if we're eating fresh food, we're putting more nutrition into our bodies. And then building a stronger community with understanding and empathy to Alaska's diversity. So, you know, some of the things that Alaska does have going for it, we've got 33,000 miles of coastline. And you think about nori or seaweeds, or you know, there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of unadulterated land. Many indigenous cultures with rich traditional foods. Again, unadulterated land, rich with forageable foods. We do have a frontier food culture that's trying to replicate the lower 48 in this environment. But all of that kind of equals a food circle that just kind of has some gaps in it. So for me, you know, this is kind of where fresh49.com sort of evolved from, and the thought process is behind it. And Fresh 49, we focus on catering with Alaskan ingredients, speaking events, cooking classes, and you know, we're getting ready to work on some new Fresh Alaska webisodes, solidifying some sponsors for 2013. Fresh Alaska is a focus on traditional and contemporary food supply, highlighting Alaska places, recipes, and people. And then Harvest 49, we've got three sauces. We've been selling bulk to Princess Lodges all summer, and we're actually getting ready to bottle. The original intent was to start using indigenous foods, berries, spruce tips. The hard part was that when you start putting recipes together, you start trying to figure out how to get, you know, 50 pounds of spruce tips or 30 pounds of berries without calling every grandmother and aunt and whoever else you might know. There's really not an infrastructure for that. And I just really think there's a lot of opportunity there. So over the past couple of years with Fresh49.com and these ventures, I've had a lot of really great opportunities. Last year with ANTHC, we were filming Traditional Foods Contemporary Chef, and we actually were in Stebbins and Alakanuk, and I helped pull a seal and a whale out of the Bering Sea. And I cooked it 2 days later to kind of talk about the value of cooking traditional foods well. I've traveled to a lot of the state and seen, so it's amazing because Alaska, Anchorage is not Alaska. You know, Alaska, you have to kind of get out and really see just how diverse and rich this state is. It's pretty amazing. But that said, you know, I've served traditional foods to national delegates with the National Indian Health Board. I represented Alaska in a Native Iron Chef cook-off in Washington, D.C., and I demonstrated at University of Massachusetts Amherst for Alaska Week. This last summer, I just was the guest chef for the first Oyster Festival in Juneau, and I'm the chef liaison for the Sitka Seafood Festival, which is in its fourth year, which is a very beautiful community and a very rich tradition on that island, and it's really forward-thinking as well. It's really been a pleasure to be a part of that. But all of this is done to tout how amazing Alaska is and its people, and to bring attention to this, the food culture in Alaska, and not only where it is, but where it can be. So in 2010, when we were filming some Fresh Alaska webisodes, a farmer that I was talking to in the valley had mentioned that Alaska is a food desert. And it struck me, how can I be here as an Alaska native if we live in a food desert? And that's sort of where things really started making me think about the diversification of seasonality and really how short and sweet our seasons are. But if you're looking to forage, there's actually, you can forage pretty much year round. So these webisodes kind of gave me the confidence to step out and start looking for these opportunities to highlight and promote Alaska's regional cuisine. And you know, identify, embrace, and promote Alaska's food culture. This is a three-pronged effort. So the first one is the indigenous food supply. This is a plate that we went foraging Prince William Sound this summer. So we have a seared rockfish, and that's over a foraged fried rice. It's got spot shrimp, beach greens, seaweed, and then we also integrated a farm fresh egg and local vegetables. So this is a great way of just kind of demonstrating, you know, traditional foods in a contemporary sort of atmosphere. And on top of that, it's actually super healthy for you. We really try to kind of watch excessive fats and nutritional information when we're doing this, although we don't necessarily want to tout that too much because it's education through entertainment, and there's nothing entertaining about talking about how unhealthy you normally eat, right? So this is another example of just some of the things that I've been able to do, but also some of the thought processes behind it. But this is it's a muktuk sushi roll. So what I've got is beluga fat in strips, and then behind that, if you look over, there's the green, and that's sea asparagus or sea beans, and those are fresh. So when I put this together, this was an appetizer for the Alaska Native Health Board Healthy Summer Celebration. And this really also speaks, I think, to what Alaska is in a lot of ways. It's a harsh climate, but it also really takes care of you if you let it. The whale fat or whale blubber, seal, salmon, there's a lot of omega-3 fatty acids, which are super beneficial for you. They actually help omega-3 fatty acids. They help you with sun. So and obviously, we don't get a lot of that for a lot of the year in Alaska. And the sea asparagus is procured on the beach, and so you've got a lot of the sea washing up on it, the mineral intake, you know, kind of the air evaporates into that, and there's trace minerals, huge vitamin content, and that those vitamins actually help absorb the D into your body. So to me, this is just kind of first of all, I think it's very just ingenious that indigenous Alaskans have been looking at this and using these foods in these capacities. And secondly, that, you know, like I said, if you listen to your environment, it's here for you. And even as harsh as Alaska can be. So that's kind of a thought process there. This is the finished dish. And we do have some crab in there as well. But what I really wanted to point out was the sprouts. We got those from Alaska Sprouts in Anchorage. And my buddy SJ, he grows like 6-7 different types of sprouts. He does tofu, and occasionally he does hydroponic greens as well. And I think these are the kinds of answers that we need, especially for rural Alaska, when you think about dense, nutrient-dense, perishable foods. So this would be a great, you know, hydroponic or you know, that kind of technology, I think, would really work well in rural Alaska. This is sort of another thing that I've been working with, and so on this platter we've got the sushi, and then we've got the shrimp, and over here we've got mushrooms. And what I did is they're seal stuffed mushrooms. So I didn't grow up eating a lot of seal, and for me, a lot of traditional foods, because I did grow up in a more urban environment, are a little overwhelming. But being a cook and a chef, I've gotten a chance to kind of know how to sort of identify certain personalities of food and work with it. So, you know, if you ever get a big, you know, first of all, seal is just, it's game. So it's, you don't need a lot, you know, 3-4 ounce portion is about a portion that you should be eating. But secondly, if it's, you know, if it's with, you know, for example, with this, we put it with caramelized onions and cherries, and we deglazed with orange juice. So we actually added some sweet and some tart and a little bit of like citric acid. And it really helped kind of take that sort of really, really intense experience and sort of mellowed it out. And I thought it was great. I think it's a great way to kind of look at these foods and not, you know, I've been given muktuk before, and I didn't grow up eating that, and you're just kind of given this big thing. And the textures, and, you know, sometimes it can be really overwhelming, and you're in an awkward place where you don't want to be disrespectful, but you also don't quite know how to deal with the situation. So I like to kind of take foods like this and really sort of analyze them and look at them and see how we can work with them to make them a little more appealing to people that maybe didn't grow up eating them. On the contemporary side, this is a dish that it's basically a roasted vegetable salad. All the vegetables are from the valley, and because I'm a shameless self-promoter, it's got a Harvest 49 alder smoked mustard vinaigrette on there. And while king crab is traditionally in the marketplace very driven, but it's a contemporary food that's also obviously got very traditional links to it. So You know, but this is just kind of an example of working with value-added traditional or contemporary foods. A couple of shots. This is at Pyra's Pioneer Peak Farm, and it's a U-pick farm. So you actually go out, you want potatoes, you go dig your potatoes if they're ready, carrots, beets, turnips, etc. And bringing this to light, you know, Alaska's environment, the season is short and sweet. And this is kind of where, for me, contemporary foods and technology come in hand, because we should really have a processing plant or a value-added opportunity to kind of take these potatoes and do something else so that, you know, we can sort of retain a market to keep them in a value-added capacity, cabbage, turnips, et cetera. So there's a lot of opportunity there, I think. It's just, you know, markets are 5 months long, and they sell through the winter, and then they pretty much go to seed after that. So I think there's ways to kind of drive that demand, increase what we're making, but also, you know, just use them in different avenues. And that's my daughter, and she got some free broccoli because we ate it before we paid for it at the farm. But this the same thing. I mean, there's a lot of opportunity with contemporary foods. So little note. So this was a plate that I did at the National Indian Health Board Gala, and it's National Indian Health Board Awards Gala, sorry. And what I did was a meal. I started out with a Three Sisters soup. This is sort of on a bigger plane, for the U.S. And Three Sisters, if you're not familiar, it's corn, squash, and peas. And what happens is the corn grows traditionally. The peas use the corn to grow around, and then that actually provides shade for the squash. And together, they're actually pretty much a complete meal, nutritionally speaking. And actually, even how they work in the ground, I'm not a nutritionist or any of that. I know how to cook it. But nutritionally speaking, one exudes carbon, I think, and one needs carbon, nitrogen, et cetera. So there's chemical makeups that actually complement each other as well. So you know, the first course I did was a Three Sisters soup. Three Sisters salsa with a corn soup, and I actually also made it vegan, but I was certainly not going to tell a crowd of people that I was serving them something vegan, because then it wouldn't be good. And then the entree, I actually did the Alaskan salmon, a rosehip vinaigrette, a grilled buffalo, and I did a lavender honey drizzle on that, and you can't see it, but it's a wild rice squash cake. So again, taking a lot of traditional foods and sort of just kind of presenting them in a contemporary way. And the buffalo to me really was, it started making me think about missed opportunities in Alaska with reindeer. And there is a USDA red meat industry in Alaska, but it's very fragmented. And I just really think, I don't know what the answer is, but I would love as a professional to be able to get my hands on it a little more consistently. So let's see here. This is a kind of the technology part of the effort. And this summer, I mentioned I was at the Oyster Festival for Ha'ani. And Ha'ani is a subsidiary of Sea Alaska. So what they do, Ha'ani translates literally to our land in Tlingit. And one of the first ventures that they did for this subsidiary is mariculture. So they... So what they're doing is they're investing in oyster farming in Alaska, in rural Alaska, but they're doing that in Cake and Angoon, Hoona, a lot of places, and they're trying to bring economic stimulus to rural Alaska, and in places where, you know, people are leaving these villages because it's sort of a mix of cash economy and subsistence, and cash economy usually wins, so people are leaving to go get jobs. And this is bringing economic infrastructure to those areas. And their first venture was oysters. And this is a great, to me, I think this is great because, number one, oysters, they're not traditional in Alaska. They don't grow here naturally. But secondly, they work very well in Alaska because they, just pure cold waters, and they also are very conducive to a subsistence lifestyle, because a lot of times people will be out on, you know, you can't, it's sort of a part-time long-term commitment. It's not, you don't have to be sitting at a desk 10 hours a day, 5 days a week or anything to make this work. So it's a great win-win where people can actually still live that subsistence lifestyle, but also work kind of, you know, walk the line in a cash economy as well. I'm very proud to be a part of, I was very proud to be a part of this. I'm really hoping to kind of work with them to also invest again into, you know, botanicals, berries and things of that nature, but that's yet to be determined. So this is one of the dishes that I did, and I was actually going to do, I was commissioned to do some recipes with Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute and then Ha'ani, and I was going to do a dandelion Rockefeller with reindeer sausage, and I thought that might just be a little too much, so pulled it back. It's spinach. You know, I tried to keep it somewhat healthy for what that's worth when you're dealing with, you know, butter and reindeer sausage and all that good stuff, but I was really proud of just kind of, you know, working with any kind of Alaska-centric food supplies where we can. What I was going to point out here was that the Yakutat oysters, they're almost like a Kumamoto Japanese oyster, very small and dense, beautiful little pearl of a meat in there. And then the pearl of Alaska's are sort of more like, they call them lady fingers, like long oysters with a shell and a nice delicate flesh. So it's amazing how even in Alaska, the oysters are very different. And I don't know if that's the environment or the way they're producing them, but I was really, really impressed with this, with these oysters. This is something that for me, I think about, again, like technology, and it's kind of funny to think about salt as a technology because it's obviously ancient. But for the past couple of years, it's a husband and wife, and they've been producing Alaska Pure Sea Salt and then an Alder Smoked Sea Salt. And the thing that I really like about this is now it's available. You can get it in Anchorage. You can get it in, I think you can get it nationally in a couple of places. But they've been making this for about 6 years now, and for the first 3 or 4, they were actually only selling to Eric Repair, Le Bernardin, or Thomas Keller per se. So, and this is kind of my opinion as to where I think a lot of foods are should be valued in Alaska. In case you don't know, those are pretty much iconic chefs that put out meals. Per se is a place where you're going to be spending, you know, $300 just to sit down and eat some food. So really pretty decadent. And this is sort of, for me, when I think about Alaska and I think about the fact that we don't have an infrastructure here, to grow an infrastructure here, you know, we're not really positioned like Seattle, where we've got, you know, interstates and international waters and population to traffic. So we need to think about our location, and if we're thinking about our location, we should probably be thinking about things that we can do. You know, we don't want to sell 5 million units for a nickel a piece because that's probably not going to work out. But if we work with our products and we keep them top shelf and we keep the you know, we tout the fact that, you know, we're living on this unadulterated land. The Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta is the size of Ohio, and it doesn't have any roads on it. So there's a lot of land that's just completely unadulterated. You're not dealing with a lot of, you know, a lot of pollution or anything else. And I think those are the kinds of things that we should be thinking about, not so much that we need to get, you know, a 99-cent bottle of hot sauce on a shelf somewhere, but that, you know, we can do really high-end food, really, you know, valued for the, you know, nutritional density. You know, this one has just got an amazing story behind it. Again, it's, you know, it's technology in the sense that it's new to the market, but it's also, I mean, it's just amazing. So that's kind of the inspiration for using these folks here, and they're pretty amazing people as well. Some other people that I talk about when I bring up, like, food pioneers in Alaska, Delta Junction Flour Mill, they're actually producing flour now in Alaska, and that's the first flour mill ever in Alaska that I know of. Chena Hot Springs, you know, they actually have hydroponic produce available year round, even when it's negative 40 in the wintertime. So, and they actually produce their heat through a geothermal generator, alternative energies. Meyer Farm, I'm really excited to finally meet meet this fella next month, but he's out of Bethel, and he actually uses, first of all, he's an organic farm in Bethel. Second of all, he uses fish meal. So he, you know, injects the land with omega-3 fatty acids from this beautiful fish that Alaska has to offer. And he's producing these vegetables, and he's actually so prolific with that he's exporting now out of Bethel. So these are those kinds of things when we talk about it's easier just to do, you know, get it from somewhere else, that I really don't think that's true, and we have a lot of opportunity here. Copper River Seafoods, I do work with them from time to time, and I really respect the fact that they're owned and operated in Alaska, and they catch their fish here, they process their fish here, and they send it out. And for the quantity and quality that they do, the standard operating procedure is catch the fish, freeze it, send it somewhere else, process it, bring it back, and then mark it up and sell it out. So, or send it out. So I'm just really proud to kind of know people like that and work with people. And it's not an easier. There's probably an easier way to do business, and it might even be cheaper. But it's the standard that they kind of expect for themselves and what they want to see Alaska become as well. And it's really exciting. And my friend, Alex Davis, AD Farms, I think he's got his 135th-ish consecutive farmer's market. And I think it just comes down for him to simple math, because farmer's markets are 5 months out of the year, and he needed to feed his family 12 months out of the year. So he started growing his product where he could stockpile it and then sell it year-round. So he actually this is his third consecutive year of a farmer's market. He's been selling all the way through January, February. Sometimes it's a little slim, but he's been actually renegotiating the way he grows his items, which is pretty spectacular. So when I think about all this, you know, for me, the goal is to integrate food cultures and integrating traditional foods, contemporary foods, and technology systems. We can become more independent, sustainable, healthier, and a food destination of unparalleled offerings. I think it's time for us to start thinking about being Alaskans and not trying to act like the lower 48. I think we have a lot to offer here. A couple of journeys that I've had, and this was, when I kind of start talking about this, I say that I major in awareness and accessibility of Alaska's food supply, and I minor in positive Native identity. And these experiences have really, over the past couple of years, have really brought me closer to my heritage. I grew up pretty much urban, and sort of grew my confidence for me to be, kind of grew in, from a kitchen perspective, not necessarily from being Alaska Native. So it's something that I've been kind of revisiting over the past couple of years, and this was something that really struck me. And if you've again been to Sitka, there's the Sheldon Jackson Museum, and just Sitka in itself is a wealth of history and knowledge, and it's a beautiful place. But this is the Tlingit war helmet of the war chief in Sitka, and this was worn in 1804. So Russian fur traders came through the area in 1799 and were kind of pushed out a couple years later, and they returned, and this was one of the helmets that was worn that night in the battle. Eventually the Tlingits succumbed to the Russian fur traders, but they never stopped pushing back until pretty much the United States bought the territory of Alaska in 1867. And I think about that as a whole with Alaska Natives. The tenacity and determination from actions like this to me is what kind of helped spawn like Alaska Native Brotherhood, Alaska Native Sisterhood. It started an Alaska Civil Rights Movement 20 years before the National Movement, Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. So I think it's really important to understand our histories. And I think for me, I kind of started learning this through food. Food is culture. Food is a large common denominator, and that for me has been very impactful. This is in Stebbins, Alaska, and that's a beluga whale. So we're pulling this up, and this was an amazing experience for me. This was last year, while filming Traditional Foods Contemporary Chef at Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, with Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. And we went out to this community, 700-person village on the Yukon, and Yukon and Bering Sea. And it's, I can't even really explain how impactful it was to work in a place where, to be a part of a community for just for 10 days where subsistence was, it wasn't a weekend fishing trip. It wasn't, it was really amazing to be a part of a community that really bound together. And when they were out hunting, it was for their families for their winter. And, we were on a boat, the captain of the boat, his son, got his first steel, and because he was kind of being compensated for the trip, there was a crew that came 2 hours down the Yukon from St. Mary's, and he actually gave the steel to him. He's like, my freezer's full, you guys came this way. And those are the kinds of things that you sort of tend to forget about a lot of times living in Anchorage, a little more insular, a little more independently inclined, but a location is a place, and people make a community. And it's been really amazing to kind of be a part of different communities around the state of Alaska. So super, super amazing and super impactful. And this is actually in, if I'm not mistaken, like late September. And it was pretty, pretty placid for being out on the Bering Sea in a skiff, apparently. So that was really lucky. But that said, using the common denominator of food, my goal is to promote the regional bounty Alaska has to offer. I'm of the belief by merging traditional knowledge, contemporary markets, and technology that we can reward rural populations for traditional knowledge, grow an in-state food program, and again, become an unparalleled culinary destination. And let's see, and then really I just want to thank the Smithsonian Arctic Studies program for giving me this platform. And I think that's about it. So thank you for your time. And I guess I'm going to be answering some questions if there are any.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Chef Rob Kanin. He was recorded speaking on Alaska's food culture at the Anchorage Museum Smithsonian Spotlight Lecture Series on October 4th. You can view his photo slideshow on our website at alaskapublic.org. We also have some of his Fresh 49 webisodes posted on Town Square 49 at alaskapublic.org. Following his talk, Chef Kanin responded to questions from the audience. First, he was asked to talk about his Alaskan sauce line launched this past summer.
The sauces that I'm producing, we have an Alaskan lager cocktail sauce, an alder smoked mustard vinaigrette, and then an onion smoked mustard Alaskan lager sauce that was pretty much dreamt of being the sister unit to the Alaskan bratwursts. So, and again, I'm actually working, we're getting ready to bottle those, and then I'm thinking about, I'm working with another entity right now on procuring traditional foods to kind of work with those and grow the sauce in that direction as well.
Next, another audience member asked Chef Kanin to recommend a good halibut recipe.
My mind is spinning too much. I mean, I've got a lot of, you can actually, I don't think I have anything on my website, but if you want to email me, I can work with you on that too. A really simple baked preparation. I mean, I was doing some work for Copper River Seafoods in the Midwest, and they had a 1-2-3 thing where they just basically took the fish, literally it was defrosted, I think it was 10 minutes per inch of thickness, and baking it. And that's the best thing I can say with halibut is just don't do too much to it because it's so amazing by itself. So keep that in mind.
Another audience member asked Chef Kanin to talk more about the Ha'ani oyster farms operated by Sea Alaska.
The mariculture manager is really, right now, I mean, they literally, the summer I was down there in Juneau this summer, that was the first year that they had just, this is the first season that they've kind of, they've been working with them. So they are really just kind of exploring everything. And I think they have a couple of contracts, even in Anchorage, but I think it's sort of under the radar until they just kind of get everything in the right place. They want to make sure they don't get overwhelmed with demand because they are, I think the way it works is the first 3 years, I think you get like 30 or 40% of the yield, and then the next year is 60 or 70, and then it's kind of functioning at a higher yield. So just they're kind of, you know, working that out. But I know that we've talked about national levels as well. I mean, obviously there's a lot of markets, you know, through the Midwest that are would be very competitive with that.
Where do you see yourself in 5 years? Possibly opening your own restaurant?
In 5 years, where do I see myself? Happy? I'm not sure. Happy cooking really good food in Alaska. That's yet to be determined. I don't know. Yeah. If the right opportunity came around, I could see it working out either way.
The next question from the audience. Are fiddleheads part of traditional cooking? Do you know anything about the food illness related to fiddlehead ferns?
I know with fiddlehead ferns, I would say yes, they're traditional. I know they're very, very popular with foraging. So I've definitely cooked with them. So I would probably say yes, but I couldn't tell you specifically that there's, you know, one area in particular that used them. You know, a food illness with fiddlehead ferns, I think the funny thing about that is that if you're getting fiddlehead ferns in Alaska, they're actually usually in a restaurant, which is where that incident happened. They're cultivated and brought in from somewhere else, so they're not local. But at the same time, I guess, you know, the one thing to think about is that nature isn't benign. So just because, you know, I've had a lot of people, it kind of drives me nuts looking through foraging books because, for example, yarrow is pretty traditional. It's been used as a tea. I've done things on video with it, like put it in wilted dishes and used it in those capacities. And then I was looking in a book the other day and it said it was poisonous and that traditionally people would take a big wad of it and stick it in their mouth to numb their mouth to do dental work or something like that. So the main thing to remember is just that just because it says it's edible doesn't mean that your body particularly, you know, can handle that. But in that specific incidence, I believe that those were cultivated from somewhere else. And again, with almost, you know, there's a lot of different, you know, devil's clubs, you know, the big thing that I've heard, fireweed, almost anything you're picking, they say in the spring it's food and in the winter it's, and in the fall it's medicine. But there are definitely property changes throughout the year. So that's again, something to know too, is when you're picking it or when you should pick it. Absolutely.
The last question from the audience was, can you recommend a good book for foraging in South Central Alaska?
A book for foraging in South Central. You know, the big standby, the standard that I've seen is Janice Schofield. And I've used, she's actually got this enormous encyclopedia thing that's huge. And then she's got some smaller books that are just kind of, you know, fit in the back pocket. And that's what I have. And what I really like about it is, number one, there are color photographs. And so it's not, you know, a lot of times you look at these books and there's a drawing and you're kind of like, it's just not the same when you're out in the woods looking for something. And then secondly, is that it actually, instead of, you know, A, B, C, D alphabetically, it actually has the foraged item in its environment. So it'll say like beaches, sandy areas, plains, and then mountainous, or, you know, it'll kind of, so you're, if you're in that area, you know, so you're sitting on the coast, you can actually look, you know, on the beach area and kind of start there versus just kind of thumbing through a whole book. So for something like that, that's what I'd recommend. Right, thanks.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Chef Rob Kanin. He responded to questions from the audience following his talk on Alaska food culture, recorded at the Anchorage Museum Smithsonian Spotlight Lecture Series on October 4th, 2012. You can view his photos from his talk as well as some of his Fresh 49 webisodes at alaskapublic.org. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.